Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, January 13th, 2022, at 11 a.m. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, wishing you all a Merry Christmas and better and brighter stories of your own in the new year.
Everybody, I'm Rose Maddox, and I'd like to tell you that you're listening to KBOO in Portland, Oregon, the station that I listen to when I'm in the area.
Welcome to an encore episode of Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and today we're celebrating an anniversary. It was 19 years ago this week when this show first went on the air. And our first ever guest back in 2003 was Craig Thompson, the celebrated graphic novelist behind the books Blankets, Space Dumplings, and Habibi. Today, we'll be re-airing a more recent conversation with Craig from May of 2018, when his sketchbook travelogue Carnet de Voyage was being re-released. Before we get started, I'd like to remind all of our listeners that we are currently in the midst of KBOO's all-important membership drive. We hope that you've been enjoying our programming and that you'll take a moment to join our year-end campaign. Because we're still being cautious and not yet opening up our studios, we don't have volunteers in the station to take your calls right now, but you can show your support by giving online, kboo.fm, or text KBOO to 44321. KBOO is one of the very last media outlets that still brings you local and independent news, music, and public affairs. We've been doing this here in Portland for over half a century, and this program has been coming to you for 19 years now, inviting important cultural figures into the studio and venturing out to events that might fly beneath the radar of the big media monoliths. So yes, you can support this very special programming today by going online to kboo.fm/give. Or simply text KBOO to 44321. And if you prefer to go analog, we're always happy to receive a contribution in the mail. The address of the station is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. And now, Craig Thompson, recorded on May 10th, 2018. Craig Thompson, great to have you back on Words and Pictures.
Oh, man, thanks to be back.
I want to ask you about Carnet de Voyage. The title translates roughly as travel notebook, and this is your sketchbook travelogue from the spring of 2004, when you were touring Europe behind the French and Spanish language publications of Blankets.
Yeah, so it was it's like my real life travel diary, pretty much unfiltered, unedited, drawn in 2.5 months, and also published within that same. Like, I had about 1 week to do all the production while I was in France while still traveling. Book went to press while I was in France, and I continued book tour throughout Europe. I was in Netherlands and London and Germany, and the book was in print by the time I got back to Portland.
Well, one of the things you get from the book is just how frantic this book tour is and how frantic you were at the time. For those of us who remember our 20s, it's easy to look back wistfully at our lost passions or sometimes sheepishly at how naive we were. Carnet de Voyage is very confessional. Nearly every page has a vignette where you're wearing your heart on your sleeve. And, you know, looking back a decade or more, did you just feel like cringing a little bit, or were you tempted to go back and change just a few of the details?
All of the above. Certainly it parades all those sort of young, naive things. If I started changing things, though, I would have gone through every page. So I did want to preserve this sort of bookmark of where I was at that age, at that point in my life. And I didn't want to tamper with that. And, you know, as much as I also keep like a prose or a written diary, those are completely burnable and cringeworthy. Anytime I stumble upon an old diary, I'm like, why do I still have this? I have to destroy this before anybody else stumbles upon it. But with things I've drawn, I have a different attitude towards. I'm actually really grateful that I took that moment to draw an experience. It really transforms it. And kind of as much as this book, Carnet de Voyage, is still in my neurotic sort of whiny internal, mindset. When I'm drawing, I'm also pulling that outside of myself. I'm really more present with the outside world in drawing than I am with writing.
Yeah, I mean, unlike Blankets or Chunky Rice or Habibi, this book took shape almost like an improv exercise or automatic writing. You know, you're discovering all these new places and people, and the narrative just keeps moving forward. There's no going back to edit yourself or tidy things up.
Yeah, exactly. It is my unfiltered diary. The strange thing is there is a three-act structure to the book that I noticed only recently, actually, when I was working on this this new edition with extra material, that there is three acts. The first act is the month of March when I'm in Morocco alone traveling. Second act is the month of April in France, mostly catching up with friends and French cartoonist influences. And then the third act, May, is book tour, but also this sort of idealized travel romance, which really made for actually the ideal sort of closure for the narrative, too.
Yeah, I noticed, as readers, we're always looking for patterns. And the through lines I found in the story were there's your romantic heartbreak, there's your cultural awakening, you're opening your heart to new friends, and your guilt at being a representative of America, in a time of occupation, because you were traveling through Europe and North Africa, mainly France and Morocco, 1 year after the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
Yeah, and that was, being in Morocco, a huge component of that was my later book, Habibi, was in its earliest conception in my brain. I hadn't started writing it, but I knew I needed to go to an Islamic country. Morocco just happened to be the most accessible, both geographically, but also culturally. It was a much more liberal Islamic country. But I was right there. I was in Spain. I was in France. I'm like, oh, easy. And it's there I started a lot of my first conversations about Islam that informed Habibi. There was all kinds of things happening at that time. And that sort of theme still continues for me when I travel to places like that, of like feeling apologetic for my country, trying to represent maybe a more positive side of the people here rather than our government and the way we behave internationally.
Well, one fun thing that happened in Morocco is you grew your first beard, and people would ask you if you were a Muslim.
Yeah, now everybody has a beard, but I was really playing it by the book with my Lonely Planet guide, where it was giving you all these rules for how to behave in a Muslim country. So I was wearing a full sleeves and full pants all the time in this scorching weather, even though you'd see all these other Western tourists just in basically bikinis. And I just for convenience sake, I'm like, I'm packing really light. I'm not going to bring a shaver. So I end up growing this pretty gnarly beard. It was great. It was a great conversation piece because I'd end up at somewhere and someone would be like, oh, you're a Muslim, huh? And then I'd be like, no, I don't have a religion. But then we'd get in depth about spirituality and the way we grew up. And there was a good blend of, I guess I learned the lesson I needed to learn to write Habibi, which is that these people basically had the exact same upbringings as me, coming from a Christian fundamentalist household. kind of had the same morals and rules, certainly the same stories that shaped our upbringings, and they're beautiful conversations.
Yeah, it's interesting how similar that fundamentalists are across the spectrum, but they're always resisting that truth. And then you've got all the mystical, you know, ends of all the religions, like Sufi in the case of Muslims, Quakers, Kabbalah people, and they're fine with being similar. You know, they're fine with being compared. They're, you know, like you were saying in the book, you believe that it's the same God for everybody.
And it's definitely those esoteric dimensions of all those, you know, faiths that I'm drawn to. Gnostics, you could reference to in Christianity, and this belief that that we are all connected, and then sort of this sort of spiritual message is something coming from within each of us.
You mentioned being influenced by your friend Lewis Trondheim, the famous comics artist who did a series called Carnet de Bord of comics diaries and observations, and he just absolutely pushed you into sketching every day, drawing every day.
Yeah, those French cartoonists are way more. They have like a joie de vivre with the way they draw. It's sort of integrated with everything they're doing. There's a pleasurable quality to it. And Lewis would brag to me that he only works 2 hours a day. He spends 2 hours in the morning doing comics pages, and the rest of his day is play. But in fact, there's a lot of creativity integrated in all that playtime. But the only part that he considers like focused work time is like 2 hours, and the rest of his life is pleasure.
Yeah, the French are all about pleasure.
I know. And meanwhile, I feel like my style's often this very tortured, neurotic, sort of classic American cartoonist style of working.
Right. They talk about how all the pleasures are tied up with guilt in America. And, well, the French are not generally known for their high esteem for Americans. But yet, in Carnet de Voyage, you seem to encounter very little criticism along the way. In fact, your sketchbook seemed to be your charm, a talisman of sorts, whether in Europe or in North Africa.
Certainly it was my communication device, because I'm pretty ignorant when it comes to language acquisition. I was trying to learn some French then, and I'm still trying, but I haven't made much progress in 14 years. So there was always this language barrier. I didn't speak Arabic, I didn't speak French, I didn't speak Spanish. It was drawing that was the tool I had to communicate with others. And then it worked, so I'm grateful for that.
If you don't mind, I'd like to have you read from some of the final thoughts, the little epilogue from Carnet de Voyage, because this is a really interesting way of kind of summing up probably why you decided to re-release the book.
Okay, yeah. It's always weird for me to read from my books. Like, if I do a book event, I don't read from them, because I feel like they always have to, it's intertangled with the drawings. Like, the words on their own don't seem to carry the weight, but let's give it a go. Why bother traveling? To connect with the world? To lose oneself? A desperate flight from the realities of home, or a desperate hunt to find a new home? The illusion of movement. The shift in scenery jars us enough to remind us to be present. Our lives are not books. They're not that delicate and well-crafted. They're sketches. Spontaneous, delicate, not fully realized.
You know, it's strange the difference that 10 or 15 years can make. I suppose if you went back to Marrakesh now, the souks and the medinas would be full of people carrying mobile phones.
Yeah, exactly. It'd be completely different the way I would navigate myself as a traveler too, having a phone or access to Google. And then also, you know, that was my first time really being to an exotic place, a country outside of Western Europe. And so I was a very naive, inexperienced traveler, really uncomfortable in my own body. So I like to think I've improved a little in terms of my travel graces. But yeah, the country itself has changed a lot. Like, I grew up in a really small town in rural Wisconsin, and it feels like a place outside of culture. It was pre-internet, you know, like there was no consciousness of the outside world, just like a lot of those countries, like small towns in Morocco or something. And now that doesn't really exist. Now that we have this communal, you know, worldwide connection, it changes the way we think of ourselves and each other.
Yeah, you talk about how Wisconsin's changed since you were a kid. There are a lot of rural folks in your parents' community who are back to the landers. The pastor of your church was kind of a hippie Jesus freak guy who wrote inspirational songs to play on the guitar. And yeah, nowadays, it's really weird how the evangelical movement's been hijacked by Paul Ryan and Scott Walker and all these Ayn Rand adherents. But yeah, it's sad to see that kind of back to the land, rural consciousness being sort of led around by these figures of mammon, I suppose.
Yeah, and I don't know how to explain that. I mean, my parents' church started in people's living rooms. It was just a couple families, two or three families at first. And then throughout most of my childhood, they were renting space at at the town hall at one point. Sometimes we'd rent time in other churches. We had this little storefront place with pillows on the floor. We just all hold hands and strum guitars. So it was very grassroots sort of, down to earth sort of thing. But then around the time I was in junior high, my parents' church bought a building, or they built a building, like a very classic evangelical bomb shelter looking church. And that's when all the politics started to shift, because they had debt and money became such a big issue for the church. And so it brought in the bigger space brought in some new, more conservative congregation members, but it also drove away people that wanted a more purist, Jesus freak sort of community. And they kind of got rid of the hippie carpenter musician pastor and got a more traditional fire and brimstone pastor. And with the economics, the spirituality of the church shifted.
And you see in Blankets, your character is having debates with these newer pastors, these kind of slick guys in these mega church settings, and you're kind of advocating for the communal kind of groove of the Book of Acts.
I was pretty obsessed with Jesus and Jesus's teachings, but I was really resistant against the organized religion and the sort of conservative Christian church, the hypocrisy of it, and recognized early on in high school that it was in complete defiance of all of Jesus's teachings. And now more than ever, of course, having Trump as president. There's a great article about this actually in Atlantic recently about how evangelicals got hooked on Trump and lost their way. And that's a whole nother podcast, right?
You're listening to an encore episode of Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and the guest in the studio is Craig Thompson, author of the graphic novels Blankets, Space Dumplings, and Habibi. Before we get back to the conversation, I'd like to take a moment to remind our listeners that KBOO is in the midst of our membership drive. We hope that you've been enjoying our programming and that you'll take a moment to join our year-end campaign. There are all kinds of ways to pledge your support to KBOO. On the web, you can visit kboo.fm/give. You can also text KBOO to 44321. And if you prefer to go analog, we're always happy to receive a contribution in the mail. The address of the station is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Again, the webpage is kboo.fm/give. On your mobile device, you can text KBOO to 44321. And of course, you can reach us by mail at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. And now let's talk some more with our guest, Craig Thompson.
Well, you are stubbornly analog when it comes to your drawing materials. You still really put your trust in brush pens and inks and pencils and paper, and you just seem to like that texture, that feel of working with the hand, putting the whole body into the creation of art.
Yeah, so my previous book before this, Space Dumplings, which is sort of an all-ages sci-fi comedy adventure, that book I ended up penciling digitally on a Wacom Cintiq. And I wanted to learn the technology partly because my previous career was as a graphic designer, so I used to be really up to date with all my software. And so I'm like, oh, all the kids are using these Cintiqs this day. I got to learn this technology. And I found it useful as a tool to pencil and kind of lay out and compose the book, but I completely hated creating the final art on it. The line felt really insincere to me, basically. And also, I just don't like being in front of a screen for that portion of a day. So I used it through the whole book to pencil it, but then I would print out, this is like a blue line, and then ink straight on paper with a brush, and kind of getting, that was the pleasure part of making the pages. Like, I need that tangible, like you said, textural quality.
So the pages of Space Dumplings, the final inks were on paper?
Yes.
Oh, then you handed them back to your colorist, Dave Stewart, who's kind of a rock star colorist in the comics world. So, yeah, I suppose they probably would have loved to have that be digital rather than going through the process of scanning it, but I'm sure it looked way better the way you did it.
Oh, maybe. You're right, though. I probably added too many steps, that more than were necessary. And color is one thing where I really believe in digital, actually, because I've, you know, done illustration throughout the years, too, but I'm not like, I don't know. I like the fact that I can edit and change colors if they're done digitally up to the last minute rather than if you're doing analog watercolor.
And there's a new project coming up that you're not ready to talk about yet, but it's a limited color.
Yeah, it's just going to have one additional color, which I like. Actually, that's the kind of color I like to do. When I was doing a lot of illustration stuff, I like to think of most of my work as screen prints or printmaking. Like, oh, how would I do this if this was a woodblock print or a screen print? And work with maybe four colors, not an infinite array. I think that much freedom is sort of suffocating and muddies the composition.
Yeah, well, Space Dumplings, okay, this was your first full-color graphic novel, as we said. It's a sci-fi adventure story for all ages. I couldn't help but notice that some of the same themes in Space Dumplings were addressed in blankets. There's a protagonist who belongs to a working-class family with a handyman dad, you know, and unlike your dad, who is a plumber, Violet's dad fixes up spacecraft, but there's definitely that distrust of the, you know, the fancy schmancy aesthetic folks who live comfortable lives.
Yeah, with Space Dumplings, I was really meditating a lot on the sort of political social class divide in the country, the red states and the blue states. I mean, it's reflected in the characters. The protagonist is this little, maybe 12-year-old girl named Violet. But her parents' names essentially mean red and blue, and she's supposed to be the sort of bridge between these sort of warring factions in the country. But yeah, I come from, I mean, Wisconsin traditionally is actually a blue state, but only recently switched. But I come from this very conservative Christian working class stock, which has a huge mistrust of the academic and the, and you know, these are sort of like disillusioned white working class people, which are the Rust Belt people that basically got Trump elected.
Well, and the rural areas where you're from used to be farmer labor areas that were very progressive originally in Wisconsin. The working class folks were extremely in favor of, say, FDR's New Deal.
Exactly. And my dad's been a lifelong union member. You know, he believes in the union, and yet that's in conflict with how he's been voting politically.
Well, going back to the similarities, there are plenty of biblical references in Space Dumplings. The mascot character, who's appeared in so many other books of yours, is named Zacchaeus. That's after the tax collector in the gospel stories, I'm assuming?
Yes, the wee little man in the sycamore tree.
And there's also callbacks to the story of Jonah from the Hebrew scriptures, maybe with a bit of Moby Dick and Pinocchio thrown in.
Yep. And in even what I was writing this morning for my next book, my new project, there's a lot of biblical references. And I keep saying that I'm going to stop doing biblical references in my books, but it can't help but seep in. It's like my entire childhood and programming.
Well, you're mentioning that Carnet de Voyage was a warm-up to the idea that you had for Habibi. And well, I have to ask you first, when you first came up with Habibi, it was a completely fictional story. Was that partly in a response to blankets, a way of getting as far as possible from contemporary Midwestern realism?
Yeah, exactly. After blankets, I was sick of drawing myself. I was sick of drawing these very mundane sort of Midwestern landscapes, and I wanted to do something that was either fantastical, a la Lord of the Rings, or really socially, politically like relevant, like Joe Sacco's comics journalism. And what ended up happening was somewhere in between, you know, like a fairy tale, Arabian Nights sort of fairy tale that was drawing on all these themes around the sort of like Islamophobia in the country and water crisis, many different things. Like,
You're a fan of the Thousand and One Nights, those cliffhanger tales that Scheherazade tells to King Shahryar, and they can be very sexual, very scatological, very naughty in many ways. Not the sort of high literature that everybody expects.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're way more risque than anything hinted at in Habibi.
So I think you've said something along the lines that Habibi was intended as something of a mashup of sacred texts and pulp fiction.
Yeah, I think it was influenced a lot by when I was a kid, there was all these sort of comic book versions of the Bible, where they take Bible stories and turn them into cartoons, and that's a very blend of the sacred and profane. I guess Crumb did it too with his Genesis graphic novel. There's a chapter in Habibi which has no images, so I kind of adhere to that sort of Islamic rule of the prohibition of representational imagery, because in a way I get it. There is something about the drawing that's profane, where the word is the beginning. In the beginning was the word. It's very pure.
Yeah, well, we were talking about how you like the analog technology. And Habibi, I mean, you really kind of went overboard. You spent days just creating these geometric illustrations on the page all by hand. I mean, you even avoided scanning the patterns and duplicating them. So there's always a variation between the shapes, the little quirks in the way they fit together. And I guess that's true to life. Islamic artists will often break a pattern deliberately. They'll interrupt the order in logic, because I guess geometric forms were thought to embody the divine order of the universe.
Yeah, and they kind of do, right? But for me, too, it was a lot of like connecting with craftspeople or artisans around the world. Like there's something weird about the role of the artist in the Western world, where they're sort of lifted up on a pedestal and maybe paid inappropriately or whatnot. And I just wanted to kind of connect with the way craftspeople, I don't know, the sort of purity of like craft making in different cultures.
Yeah, I know. I remember that you complained a little bit about some of the Western artists who aren't really artists. They're sort of commissioning works from craftsmen who never get their names.
Yeah, they're overseers, essentially.
Yeah, the so-called artist that comes to mind is Jeff Koons. He'll put a name on one of his epic sculptures, but, you know, all he really did was bring home a Mylar balloon and tell his assistants, make this in metal. You know, no real familiarity with the materials. I mean, I'd respect the guy a lot more if he'd sign up for an art welding class at the community college.
Yeah, I agree. In Walla Walla, Washington, there's this amazing, what do you call it? They cast those pieces, like Yayoi Kusawa or Jeff Koons or Paul McCarthy. Massive, massive, incredible modern art sculpture is being crafted there in Walla Walla, Washington. But it's all being crafted by high school and college students and Mexican laborers. And those pieces are selling for millions, but none of the artists touch those pieces.
That's amazing. And you've said that you think of your comics as calligraphy in a way, and that kind of ties in with Habibi. You know, just that the calligraphy is really just as much a movement, a body movement, as an artistic expression.
Yeah, I know that Chris Ware, a more famous cartoonist than I, talks about comics as sheet music. Like it's sort of like these symbols or typography that your brain sort of converts into this musicality or this rhythm. And that resonates with me. Only the thing that's different is Chris Ware really talks about removing sort of the calligraphy and the line. He really believes in sort of the typography of the symbols of cartooning. And I also want to capture that musicality in the way that the ink hits the paper, you know, that sort of raw beginning of human expression feeling of mark making.
Well, Craig Thompson, we have limited time, but we'd love to have you stick around and talk some more, and we'll throw up some more audio on the web. That would be great.
Sounds great.
In the meantime, you've started an Instagram with your brother Phil, features lots of wacky looping animations. Where can people find out about you and your other books and projects?
I have a Instagram that's just at SpaceDumplins, without a G, SpaceDumplins. I have a blog, a website, CraigThompsonBooks.com. Those little animations you're referring to are called TractorBeams.tv. We couldn't get .com, so TractorBeams.tv. And those are good places to start.
Well, Craig Thompson is the author of the graphic novels Blankets, Habibi, and Goodbye Chunky Rice, as well as the sketchbook travelogue Carnet de Voyage. Craig, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you, Kunsh. It's been an honor.
Well, we hope that everybody has been enjoying our special 19th anniversary episode of Words and Pictures, recorded in May of 2018 and featuring celebrated graphic novelist Craig Thompson. Before we go, I'd like to remind all of our listeners that this community radio station needs your support. To become a member of KBOO or to arrange for a donation of any size, please visit kboo.fm/give. You can also text KBOO to 44321. Or if you prefer, you can mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Again, the webpage is kboo.fm/give. On your mobile device, you can text KBOO to 44321. And of course, you can reach us by mail at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on social media at Words and Picture.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, listener-supported community radio. Stay tuned for Shocks of Sheba, up next after these headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO.